Osiris.
Hi, this is Jordan with Spafford, and the podcast you are listening to is part of the Osiris Network. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with podcasts and live experiences about artists and topics you love. Sign up for the newsletter at osirispod.com to stay in the loop.
Today's episode of The Road to Now is a re-air of an episode that we originally launched on October 10th, 2016, The History of Voting Rights with Dr. Pippa Holloway. Given last week's referendum to restore voting rights for felons in Florida, we thought it was a good time to air this episode, to not only celebrate the fact that so many people have gotten their voting rights back, but to remind everyone of why this is a cause that we should care about and why the people of Florida did the right thing. We also caught back up with Pippa and had her give us catch-up on what happened in Florida, why it was successful, and what strategies we can learn from looking at how the people of Florida were able to help their fellow citizens get their rights back. So please enjoy The Road to Now, number 23, 2.0, The History of Voting Rights with Dr. Pippa Holloway. We are here with Dolph Ramsor, who you may know is the sponsor of our podcast, the original sponsor of our podcast, the godfather of North Carolina music.
Dolph being a sponsor of our show literally helps us keep the lights on, keeps batteries in the Zoom recorder, keeps the microphone cables working. Dolph, we appreciate all your support over the past year.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be a part of it.
We've been running an ad for the Ruin Brothers, which is one of the new albums that came out that you guys put out, but was produced by Rick Rubin, correct?
Correct. Correct.
I texted Dolph after the second time we ran it and told him that I've never seen a more effective advertisement because it had worked on my entire family. Because after I heard that ad on my own podcast a couple times when I was editing it, my wife listens to the Ruin Brothers all the time now, and I've listened to that album several times. It worked on us, man.
Well, that's great to know. That's great. And they're such talented guys, and they're sweet fellas as well. They're from the north of England, Scunthorpe, which is a very working class area, but they're really good guys.
Dolph, you have a few newer groups on your roster. Is there anybody that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, we just signed a band called Sammy Miller and the Congregation, and that's a unique one because it's a jazz band, and this is the first jazz band I have worked with. But they're a very unique band because it's kind of joyful jazz. They do a lot of comedy bits within the jazz that they play. It's really unique. It's almost very much like early Avett Brothers, when you had to go see the band to sort of get it.
So yeah, so we're grateful we had you as sponsors. And as I said the first time we had you on in the introduction, maybe over a year ago, and I said that I've known Dolph over a decade, and he's only ever sponsored really good things and put his name behind really good things. And I didn't know if this was going to be the one that broke him, and I didn't want to be a part of it. But a year later, we're still going, and we're thankful for it.
Well, again, glad to be a part of it, and y'all keep rocking. I'll keep rocking and having some fun doing it.
Big team, little me.
Yes.
That's right. So check out the Ruin Brothers album and all the other albums and the bands on Ramsor Records. You can go to ramsorrecords.com, and you can, if you're interested in any of the albums there, you can enter the promo code HISTORY and get 10% off. So go do it. Show Dolph some love, and we're thankful for him.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. I'm Bob Crawford.
And I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now.
Ben, we had a great interview yesterday with a good friend of yours.
That's right. We had Dr. Pippa Holloway on the podcast. I was really excited because, you know, I have a lot of great colleagues at MTSU, and I think the history department there is exceptional. And there are a couple people that I really want to have on the podcast, and I don't want to bring them all at you guys at one time. You know, we want to diversify what we're doing. But Pippa was my number one choice to have on because she is an activist in her work, and she is humane, and she's a great neighbor. She's a great citizen in our community. And her book that she just published a few years ago, Living in Infamy, Felon Disenfranchisement and the History of American Citizenship, which was published in 2013 by Oxford University Press. I read this book. I got to know Pippa, and we rode to school a couple times together. We carpooled. We both live in Nashville and work in Murfreesboro. And she was telling me about it, and I was like, I've got to get this book. And I got it shortly after it came out and read it. And it stuck with me. It's one of these books that really that gives you information that I think really, if you read this and you engage it correctly and you keep your mind open, it's going to change the way you view the present in terms of the way that we treat prisoners and the way that we treat them after they have served their time. And so I read the book. It was brilliant. And so I was happy whenever Pippa agreed to be on our podcast. She came over to the house. Bob was in, where were you, Bob?
Memphis, Tennessee.
Oh, yeah, Memphis, Tennessee. So, yeah, we had a great conversation, and I'm happy that I can share my neighbor, my colleague, and a great member of our community with our listeners.
Since Ben and I started doing this, all I've heard is Pippa Holloway. Even Stacy Wood knows Pippa Holloway.
Yeah.
So really exciting to have such an esteemed professor on the show.
Yeah. In fact, we've contacted historians that we're working on coming, you know, bringing on the podcast, some that we haven't had on yet. But one of the biggest questions I get whenever I tell them I'm from MTSU is, do you know Pippa Holloway? And I'm like, of course I know Pippa.
Enjoy the conversation.
Pippa Holloway, welcome to The Road to Now.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited because, you know, I work at MTSU and I have some great colleagues there. And this is, it's a great history department. And, you know, I realize that I'm always on the podcast. So there is always somebody from Middle Tennessee State here. But I've got Pippa Holloway is my neighbor. She's my colleague. She wrote a great book that just came out like 2014. I got it when it came out and read it. Blew my mind. I work her, what she talks about in her book, into my classes now. And so, given my brief introduction, Pippa, could you introduce yourself and tell everybody what you're working on now?
Sure, yeah. So my name is Pippa Holloway, and I'm a professor of history at Middle Tennessee State University. And as Ben pointed out, I published my book, Living in Infamy, Felon Disfranchisement and the History of American Citizenship. I think it actually came out in December 2013, but it seems like I should know the answer to that. But I mean, you may be right. You say you want to know what I'm working on now, or you want to...
Let's talk about the book that,
okay,
that you wrote, and kind of... Because right now we're at this point where felon disfranchisement has been a big issue, particularly within the state of Virginia, the discussions there. We currently have four states, I believe it is, that permanently disfranchise felons.
Mm-hmm.
And according to some statistics, almost 6 million Americans right now are disfranchised because of previous criminal convictions. And... You know, this is one of the things where, from the present perspective, it looks fairly neutral. It looks like, oh, well, they've done this thing, and so therefore they you know, they've done the crime, served the time type of thing. But there's really a deep history to this that you uncovered in your research that has a lot to do with race and with the history of labor status in the country.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's got it's got a history that's connected to race, and it's got a present that's connected to race. These are laws that still have big disproportionately racial impacts. And yeah, one of my arguments is that that's not a coincidence. That's that the racial disparities today are connected to the racial disparities that were intended when these laws were first enacted.
You know, this goes back to an earlier episode that we did with Thomas Hanchett in Charlotte, talking about the roots of segregation and how segregation was not always the way it was. The laws, mm-hmm. the laws of segregation were put there at particular times for particular reasons as a way of separating power from one class of people, separating power between one class of people and another class of people.
Yeah, you're right. And you have to make that argument kind of delicately with felon disfranchisement, because it's certainly true that for a long time in history, you know, dating back to ancient Rome, there were certain crimes that resulted in a loss of citizenship, loss of rights of citizenship, such as suffrage. And you can go back to early modern Britain, or early modern Europe, English common law. And those are also times and places in which certain crimes resulted in a denial of right to vote or other rights. But what happens in the United States is a vast expansion of these laws after the Civil War, and also a downgrading of the offenses that trigger them. So the sort of short answer is that these used to be extremely rare punishments, but after the Civil War, Southern states in particular made these punishments much more common.
And what's the motivation for that?
The motivation was about race. And when you go back to the period right after the Civil War, in 1866 is the first election in which African Americans are able to vote after the Civil War. And they're voting in 1866 for the constitutional conventions that are going to be held in 1867. And in that very first election, the first, I argue, techniques to deny the vote to black voters are accusations of former crimes, that, you know, these people are criminals, these people committed crimes as slaves during the slave era, and therefore they shouldn't be able to vote. So it's kind of the, even though, like, if you look at the 19th century, poll taxes and literacy tests affected, they did more of the work of disfranchisement. So more people in the late 19th century lost the right to vote due to poll taxes or literacy tests. Felon disfranchisement was the first strategy. It was the first one out the gate in 1866 as a means of targeting African-American voters.
I think currently what we talk about in our time, and I don't want to jump around, but I'm going to, just because it's so in the news, are drug laws.
Well, you're right, because of the disparate sentencing. And that's something that's it's ticking down a little bit as a result of some of the court decisions in the past couple years that try to reduce the sentencing disparity. Specifically, the kind of famous one is the crack cocaine sentencing disparity that resulted in people that were using or selling crack cocaine getting much, much stiffer penalties than people that were using the other, you know, the purer form of cocaine. So that's kind of digging a little deep in the weeds in terms of the connection here, and you're testing the limits of my knowledge a little bit. But there definitely have been, with regard to drug laws, the most famous being crack, cocaine sentencing disparities that resulted in higher incarceration rates for African Americans in the late 20th century.
And also three strikes.
Yeah. You know, what I would actually say today, if you want to look at, and this is me, you know, not as a political scientist that's looked at the statistics here, but from what I'm reading in the law and anecdotally, is that actually the racial disparities today in many states are not so much about who's incarcerated, but who remains on probation and parole. Because many, many states, you continue to be disfranchised, even if you're not still incarcerated, but through probation and parole. And a lot of times probation is something, especially when there's private probation companies, where people stay on it for a really long time because they haven't paid off all their fines, or they continue to get nickeled and dimed on really small probation violations. So a lot of people are still under court supervision, as the law refers to it, and still can't vote. They're not incarcerated. They've done their time. But now, you know, they're picked up for driving without a license. And now that violates their probation. And now they're on probation for another year, and they still can't vote because of that. There's also an economic impact, because a lot of times you remain on probation until you finish paying certain fines, right, or fees or whatever. And those also have class disparities, which, because of, you know, economic and the connection between economics and race in America today, means that things that affect poor people disproportionately often also affect African Americans disproportionately, that as well.
Right. And you talk about this in your book as well, about how you get the origins of these felon disfranchisement policies are really in the South, and they expand to a lot of other places. They're kind of the South is a laboratory for them because of the attempt to select and cut out a group of the population, and that spreads. But then you also point out that during the populist era in the South, the opportunity to essentially incarcerate people and take away their right to vote, that works not just with race, but also with poor white folks. And that's and during the populist era, those two sides link a lot, especially in North Carolina, mm-hmm, with the fusion movement. And so, yeah, it's really, you know, it ends up largely being a class thing here.
Yeah. Again, it's definitely complicated. And I like your terminology, saying the South is kind of a lab where this is worked out. And I think that's a really good way to put it. So in the 1870s, there's this very specific effort to make felon disfranchisement apply to misdemeanor larceny. So it's actually not felon disfranchisement in the 1870s. It's just disfranchisement for crime. That is initially aimed at African Americans. So in the 1870s, a number of Southern states say, how are we going to stop African Americans from voting? And a few people say, well, one of the ways we can do it is by making petty theft a disfranchising offense. Right. You steal a fish, you can't vote. You steal a chicken, you can't vote. You steal three oranges, you can't vote. So that's the laboratory is the South, and the lab subjects, to push the metaphor, are African American men in the 1870s. But then that gets extended and expanded so that in the late 19th century, when poor whites in some Southern states are also seen as a threat to white democratic governance or white big D democratic power, felon disfranchisement, as well as literacy tests and other things, are also applied and used against the poor white population as well.
Yeah. And this is, I think, one of the things, going back to kind of how these laws are created, I think one, you know, I think most people who look at this and don't understand why felon disfranchisement is a problem say, well, it's just common sense. Don't commit the crime if you don't want to if you don't want to have, you know, lose something. And what they don't understand is that this isn't a simple, like, when people are passing this legislation in most of these legislatures, they're not simply saying, yes, if a general person commits a crime, then therefore they shall lose their right to vote. What they're saying is, and you've pointed this out in your research, they're specifically talking about who they're going after in some of these discussions in the legislatures.
Oh, yeah, they definitely are. And they say things like, well, this is great. This is going to really, you know, erode the African-American electorate. This is really going to, you know, this is going to put a stop to black voting. That's something that's very much like it's on the forefront of these right. discussions in the 1870s.
And you point out the way that that I want to go back and say this. This is one of the things that I think a lot of people don't understand about the post-Civil War South. A lot of folks, and I don't know, you guys have almost certainly been to plantations and these historic houses that have since been turned into monuments to the people who lived there. I don't know if this is just me that gets this a lot, but there's always that awkward moment where plantation houses, they have to acknowledge the fact that the person who lived there lived off the backs of other people's work. You know, and they don't want to do that. One of the things when I go to the Hermitage, I always will ask the people on the tour guide, I will say, who built this house when I go over to the Hermitage? And you'll find that there's two general answers that you get. One of them is, Andrew Jackson built this house, to which I can't help but respond, man, he must have been really strong if he built this house. And the other one is, well, it was enslaved people. And there's a varying degree of with which people are comfortable answering that. But one of the narratives that I always get when I go to these places is, well, not always, but I'll say a lot, is, you know, this guy right here, yeah, he owned slaves, but he was really good to his slaves. And the case that a lot of people point out to kind of try to whitewash this past is, he was so good to his slaves that after the Civil War, they didn't leave. They stayed here as if, you know, they just decided not to put in an application at the Walmart up the road, or they decided not to pursue an entrepreneurial career. And, you know, early on, Southern states are able to pass laws specifically aimed at black folks. But then you have the 14th Amendment, which makes that problematic. So then you create seemingly neutral laws, right? Seemingly neutral laws like vagrancy laws, mm-hmm. right? Which have a history going back to California, the Gold Rush, which is we make something that this group of people does illegal. And then when they do it, we arrest them. And in many cases, we say, well, now you owe us a fine. Well, you can't pay that fine because you don't have any money because you were previously considered property. Okay, well, then we'll sell off your sentence to someone where you have to work for a variety of years. And it's important to remember that, you know, a lot of folks don't see racism and don't see discriminant classism and things like this unless they're explicitly there right in front of them. But so many things that come across as neutral, if you go back and look at the history, they are saturated with not with a general like sense of like, here's what's right and wrong, these people did something wrong, but with a specific agenda politically. And in my classes, I always talk about how between the 1870s and the very beginning of the 20th century, there are, I believe, was it two black senators and multiple members of the House of Representatives at the federal level. And a lot of people don't know that. Mm-hmm. And what I always say is, you should be amazed. It is amazing to find this out, that there were black members of our federal government in the late 19th century. But what should blow your mind more is that there were none for almost three decades after that.
Right.
And that tells you a story about how effective these laws, which had to come across as neutral after the 14th Amendment, are nevertheless saturated in a real political agenda. And I've heard people talking about what's going on in Virginia now, and they say, yeah, of course, yeah, these Democrats want to get these guys voting because they think they'll vote for them. But what you got to remember is that there was not neutrality before this. The actual laws themselves were also an attempt to get other people out of the voting population. So bringing them back in is bringing us back to par. It's bringing back in people who were excluded. And I think your book does a really good job of pointing this out across the board. And then you can see it in other places, like you talk about when it goes to Idaho, mm-hmm. right? Suddenly the strategy, could you talk about that?
Yeah, so I'll go in a couple different directions off your comments, but one of them is, yeah, these laws do head west, for example. So in the 1880s, I guess, 1890s, some folks are trying to find a way to stop Mormons that are living in Idaho and Utah from having political power. And so the they start trying to find ways to use felon disfranchisement laws to target Mormons, because if Mormons are convicted of polygamy, they try to make polygamy a disfranchising offense, and that would prevent you from voting. These laws are also transferred out to Hawaii in the Hawaiian Constitution of 1898, whenever it is, a little after that. Anyway, whenever the Hawaiian Constitution is, that also, they fold felon disfranchisement into that constitution. So these laws definitely move outward from the South and target other populations. The other point I talk about is how, as African Americans begin to leave the South in increasing numbers during the Great Migration, one of the stories I tell is in St. Louis, Missouri, in 1914, when African Americans who have left the South and are now in Missouri and excited about being able to vote are targeted in a particular election in St. Louis, again with felon disfranchisement laws. And one of the newspapers in St. Louis says they're trying to Southernize the elections here. Wow. By which they mean, you know, they're trying to use the Southern strategy of felon disfranchisement against us African Americans in St. Louis. So, and that's an argument, that's a story that I want to, and I would encourage other historians to try to pursue, is how these laws and how these laws move from this laboratory of the South, as you put it, into the United States and expand over the late 19th and early 20th century.
Now, given that we're now in 2016, and I would recommend for anyone who's interested in this to read this book. It is, I got to say this, it is so perfectly concise. It is, there is nothing, there is, it's like, you know.
It's a polite way of saying short.
No. I'm telling you, like, I'm a historian. I'm also a comic. I'm telling you, the best material is that with no fat on it, right? And yours, it's such a good book, and it covers so much ground, and you do so much good research into local cases, into the story of this. And so I would recommend anyone who's interested in this in reading the book. And it's really, you'll start reading it, you won't realize before it's done. It's so good like that. But how did you get interested in this? And, you know, here we are in 2016. You know, obviously you probably started working on this book, it's published in 2013. So you probably, 2009, 2000?
I actually started thinking about this topic in 2004.
Okay.
In 2004, I was registering voters in public housing projects. Wow. I did some volunteer work here in Nashville, I guess for the League of Women Voters. I can't remember who I was actually working for. But off they sent me to the Edge Hill Projects. With a little form for people to fill out to get them to register. And what I realized as I walked around this predominantly African-American neighborhood was that a lot of the people I was trying to register couldn't register to vote. And it was this form, and you had to read the form, and it was really complicated. One of the ways that felon disfranchisement works, particularly in Tennessee still, is by making the rules for restoring voting rights really hard. And so I would go up to people and I say, you know, hey, I'm registering people to vote. And they would say, oh, I can't, I have a felony. And I would look at my form and it says, you know, if you've committed the felony between 1981 and 1993, you may be eligible for restoration. But if it's between 1971 and before 1983 and after 1971, it depends on the crime. And like, I was like, holy cow, like, how could this law be so complicated? So then I just started like, well, let me just read the Tennessee law. So, you know, I'm that kind of geeky historian. I'll go read the law, you know, it's always a good idea. So I like went and looked up the law and I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. This is the like most complicated law ever. How did that happen? So by 2007, this had turned into more than a sort of recreational question, but you know, one of the things that historians know is when you find something that looks a little strange, dig into the history of it and try to see what happened. So I started looking at Tennessee, and then I realized that I needed to broaden my search. My guess was that the Tennessee law might have something to do with laws in other states. And so I began looking at the laws in other states and the history of them. And before you knew it, there was the book.
That's amazing. So how do you see, like right now, the states, and you mentioned to me, I was texting Pip about how excited I was to come here, and her book has great implications for, you know, for understanding this, because I think really understanding that these laws weren't neutral, they were aimed at specific folks, should affect the way that we understand it in the present, right? Once again, the history informs our present case, and a lot of people would like to shake that past, and this is the kind of book that I think has implications for helping people understand how we could change this. It could affect policy. When I told you that I was excited about this, having you on, you mentioned that your work was cited in a recent case. You said it was Iowa.
Yeah. This is my first official court citation, was that the Iowa Supreme Court cited my book in a recent decision on felon disfranchisement laws there. The kind of bad news was that, I mean, I wear my politics on my sleeve here. I believe that felon disfranchisement, I think felon disfranchisement is a bad idea, and I think voting should be broad and wide. And unfortunately, the Iowa Supreme Court cited my book to make the opposite argument. The Supreme Court felt that my book supported the argument that felon disfranchisement laws, that large numbers of people, or a larger number of people in Iowa, should lose the right to vote as a result of a prior conviction. So I fear that I wasn't super helpful to the cause in Iowa, but I was glad that I'm glad that I'm being read by courts. There's some other pending legislation or pending litigation on felon disfranchisement. Virginia is obviously a really hot area right now due to the essentially dispute between the governor and the legislature as to the pardon process in Virginia.
Right.
There's a bill, I believe, in Florida right now, an effort to change the Florida Constitution to make the restoration of your voting rights easier. And there's the breaking news is in the last couple of days, a lawsuit's been filed in Alabama. Alabama has a provision in its constitution that disfranchises for crimes of moral turpitude. And if that sounds like a confusing phrase to you, it should be, because it's a phrase that actually doesn't have any legal meaning. And as far as I can tell, it's sort of left up to every individual registrar to look at a crime and be like, yeah, that looks like it's kind of an immoral thing. As I understand it, which is pretty preliminary, one of the bases for this lawsuit is in Alabama is to say that this moral turpitude language, as a measure of whether or not you should lose your voting rights, is inappropriate. And my assumption is they're arguing it has racial implications as well. Yeah, there's lots of breaking news on felon disfranchisement. I will point out that kind of one of, you know, I'm always looking for ways to step back from the book and think about like bigger picture arguments, and also how these issues change over time. When I started this project in 2006-ish, being a felon, having a prior criminal conviction was the most common reason that people lost the right to vote. You know, if you were 18 years old and an American citizen and couldn't vote, it was probably because you had a prior conviction.
Right.
And I don't know if anyone's actually been able to run numbers on this today, but my guess is that's no longer true. That today, the primary reason why an adult U.S. citizen can't vote is because they don't have a proper ID. They've not been able to obtain or provide exactly the right ID, birth certificate, picture ID, photo ID, whatever, to be able to vote. And to me, I'm not at all suggesting my book is therefore increasingly irrelevant. What I'm suggesting is that read my book also to think about the question of why America continues to pass laws that make voting harder.
Right.
Because if you look at the rest of the world, most other countries, as they change their electoral process, the kind of nuts and bolts of how you register and how you get an ID and things like that, it gets easier. Almost every other country in the world is committed to making voting easier. Whereas America is fairly unique over the trajectory of much of this century. We expand the vote, and then we do things like, you know, pass the Voting Rights Act, and then we get rid of the Voting Rights Act. And we make voting, especially in the past couple decades, harder for a lot of people. So I think that's the kind of bigger question, or one of the bigger questions. People talk about mass incarceration, but I've been trying to talk recently about mass disfranchisement as a not unrelated, but also very contemporary issue.
And I think this is another issue, speaking about IDs and kind of restrictions on who can vote. It's one of the things that I think if you take outside of its historical context, it seems like a very easy thing. If you don't understand the history, you say, well, get an ID to vote. What's so wrong with that? And I told the story in one of my classes about the story that Pippa tells about the elections in Virginia. I believe was it in the 1890s where they have the two separate lines?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
1888.
They have lines for black voters and white voters. And they have these laws on the books that say that felons can't vote. And so people line up to go vote, and the authorities show up, and they begin checking people's names to make sure they're not on a felon. They're not felons. And this really and they selectively go to the line of black folks, and they hold them up so that they're essentially can say, we're fulfilling the law. We're making sure the felons aren't voting. But they slow it down so much that at the end of the day, when the polls close, there's a long line of people who can't go in and vote.
And they're all African-American.
Right. Exactly. And so this is another case where you see selective implementation, but then you get into the 20th century and even before that, these poll tests. I would encourage anybody who wants to understand how these tests are used to look up the 1963 Louisiana poll tests. You can just Google that. It will pop right up. Mm-hmm. It's like circle the last line in this sentence. And it's like, what? I mean, the questions are unanswerable and they're selectively, you know, which one you get is usually determined by race. But when I told that story about the folks being lined up, one of my black students in my class, I saw a look on her face and she kind of like lit up and she said, "Now I know why my grandma made us get up first thing in the morning and go to the polls." We were like, why? She was always like, "Why do we have to get up and go straight there?" And she realized my grandma was alive at a time, and she lived in a time where there were attempts through poll taxes, through poll tests, through selective implementation to use seemingly neutral laws to keep my grandmother away from voting. And she wasn't going to let that stop her. And this is the thing, you got to remember that when you talk about putting barriers on things, sometimes it seems like common sense. But when you understand that today there are lots of people who are alive who remember when these seemingly neutral laws went into effect, they disproportionately affected them in their communities. And so I'm not saying that leads to an answer about what to do about this. I'm simply saying that if you don't understand why people are so worried whenever people talk about voter ID laws, it's because there have been restrictions in the past that people alive today still remember. And that's their experience.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And we're now producing a new generation of people that are going to also remember, you know, these laws in their contemporary enforcement as more and more states have increasingly rigorous requirements for having a photo identification, a current photo identification, a photo identification that matches your correct address, a photo identification in which your birth certificate has been verified. I mean, all these different parameters that are, yeah, making voting harder. We're gonna have more and more people that can tell those stories to their grandchildren if these kind of trends continue.
You love coffee.
I love coffee.
But I don't really drink coffee.
Our relationship would be so much better if you drank coffee.
I know. And that's why I don't drink coffee. But anyway. But I ordered some coffee because we have a sponsor called La Cosecha Coffee.
Salt of the earth. Jamie Jeske. Great guy. Beautiful family.
They do everything right, you know? And my wife drinks coffee. And I like coffee, like, sometimes, right? So I ordered this coffee. Ground it up. And Bob, I like that coffee.
You mean you like coffee now?
Yes.
You like La Cosecha coffee.
I like La Cosecha. And this sounds like a 1950s advertisement, but it's actually the truth. Because I didn't have to be like, we had an ad for this for La Cosecha, and it was working fine. They're getting orders from us because you guys are awesome. And apparently, repeat orders because people order it and realize how good it is.
We have a very loyal and dedicated group of listeners out there.
Yes, and
such good people.
Yeah, if you haven't tried this coffee from La Cosecha, give it a shot because honestly, I still don't drink coffee that very often, but I look forward to drinking a cup of that coffee sometimes. You can go to lacosechacoffee.com and you can go there and order some of their coffee. They have a lot of different varieties. They roast it themselves. They have direct relationships with the farms that produce them so that they get paid well. And if you go to lacosechacoffee.com and you enter the promo code RTN10, that's RTN, the number 10, you get 10% off your order of La Cosecha Coffee. And they've been great sponsors for us and good people. And you notice we've been doing this podcast for 2 years. We've only ever had two sponsors. We kind of work on the Paul Harvey model that, like, we're not, you know, we've had other people talk to us about it. We really want to believe in the stuff that we advertise, and we're happy to say that these guys are great, and we hope you'll check them out.
Please do. And Ben, your relationship with your wife will be so much better now that you drink coffee, because you guys can have a cup of coffee together in the morning.
So Bob, you're saying that every day that I don't drink a cup of coffee is me being deliberately antagonistic towards my wife and our relationship?
No, you're projecting.
La Cosecha Coffee.
Living in North Carolina, I can't help but think about the law that was passed and then struck down by the Court of Appeals recently, the voter restriction law, really voter ID laws. But there was recently a Washington Post article, and they go inside how the Republicans in North Carolina created this law. It's the article's called "Inside the Republican Creation of the North Carolina Voting Bill, Dubbed the Monster Law." It's written by William Wan. And shortly after the 2008 election, the Republicans said, "Hey, let's look at who votes, whites and blacks. Let's look when they vote. Do they early vote or do they vote on election day? Let's look at the population, the voting population, those who don't have driver's license." and they that this is how they use this data to construct a law that inordinately affected black voters over white voters. And it's just the audacity of the blatant racism that went into this bill is just it's mind blowing.
Yeah, and one of the other implications of that in North Carolina specifically, as you probably know, is just the confusion, which is that, you know, when you start changing the dates, when is the election? When can you early vote? Where can you early vote? Confused voters are voters also that are going to not vote as often. The legislature in North Carolina was very focused on figuring out, you know, what is the best way to erode African-American voting power? And one of the things they figured out in North Carolina is that African-Americans are more likely to early vote, and they're more likely to early vote on Sundays. So that's why that first Sunday of early voting, or the number of Sundays in which early voting was an option in North Carolina, was limited. But yeah, that's something that people that are working on campaigns right now in North Carolina are very cognizant of. They said there's a lot of confusion on the ground in North Carolina right now. And that's something that people are trying to mitigate through, you know, through campaign staffs and so on.
And this has a history there as well. You know, I mean, if you look at the congressional map, the districts in North Carolina, there is a bizarre one that runs kind of slash through the middle of the state. And it's like, why would you make this district? Well, that's the I-85 corridor. Yep. And where do interstates tend to go through? They tend to go through poor communities. So there is a district that just kind of stripes the state. And that was specifically as part of, you know, gerrymandering to keep a population that's probably going to vote against those who were in power at the time, concentrated in a way that we could limit their impact. And
Yes. There have been so many creative ways. And again, yeah, to make voting harder and to make it harder for people to have their voice heard and be represented in the legislature. So yeah, that's sort of that for me is the larger issue of why sort of how and why these all of these electoral practices, because they all do come together. They all build on each other.
And I do want to say here that we're talking about the North Carolina Republican Party and the people who made these decisions. I don't want you to think by any means that this is a slander of the party in general. Our good friend Doug High just wrote a great piece recently reminding everybody that even though it seems like a lot of these vocal voices in the Republican Party are absolutely going in the wrong direction, there are a number of people who were saying maybe instead of trying to keep black folks from voting, what we should do is appeal more to the black community and work harder for them. So I want to give a shout out to Doug High on that, because he's been working hard to remind us of these things. Even if pockets go bad, there's still folks who are working for the right causes.
No, and that's true of felon disenfranchisement as well. There have been some Republican governors both in Florida and Virginia that did proceed at a reasonable pace with their work of restoring voting rights. Both North Carolina and Florida governor plays a significant role in just processing these voter restorations. And I believe it was Governor Gilmore in Virginia and Governor Crist, when he was a Republican in Florida, both were Republicans that were like, no, we're going to keep processing voter restorations like the Democrats did. That's not the case now. In both of those states, the Republicans in the House and the legislature in Virginia and the Republican Governor Scott in Florida have played the partisan card and slowed those processes. But your larger point that there definitely are Republicans that believe in electoral participation that's broad-based, that believe in forgiveness, they believe in restoration of people's rights generally after incarceration, that's definitely true. You know, the vast majority, 48 out of 50 states, you can't vote if you're incarcerated. Only Maine and Vermont allow you to vote in prison. But there's an effort in California to allow people to vote who are in jails, even if it's for a felony offense. There's an effort in Minnesota to make Minnesota the third state to allow voters that are incarcerated to vote. So through all this doom and gloom, which I heartily endorse, there are many reasons to be gloomy about the state of our democracy. It's interesting and exciting to know that there are some motion in some states that are looking at expanding this particular expanding the franchise to this particular part of the population. And I'm hopeful that that trend's going to keep going in other states, too.
Could you tell us what you think the three most important things that our legislators can do to help to fix the prison situation in this country?
All right, top three. I would say, first of all, is fix the system of probation. Getting rid of private probation. If you're a private probation company, your incentive is to have people on probation.
Right.
So I would say make it make the perpetuation of probation and reincarceration for probation violations less. Make it easier to get off probation. You've done your crime. You've done your time. You're done. Don't string people out for years and years. There's a crisis of public defenders. I'd say that's another sort of big picture court issue. That when people are arrested for small crimes, they often have big incentives to plead out, to do a little bit of jail time, and then be out. And that's partly because we have overworked and understaffed public defender officers. There's a great guy called Jonathan Rapping who got a MacArthur grant last year to where he runs a group that's called the Southern Public Defender Training Center. And the idea is to really work with public defenders to get more resources, get more staff, to really give people so that when you're in court, you have the resources you need, the legal representation that you have a constitutional right to be treated fairly by that system. So I've got two so far. I've got probation. I've got public defenders. I'm going to make my third about restoration of what's the word I'm looking for? Helping people integrate back into society better after incarceration, so that the when you're released from prison, you have, for example, ban the box movements, so that employers can't ask at the front end if you've had a felony right. offense, only after they've made an informed decision about whether they want to hire you, they can ask you have a prior. Other things that make it easier for people that have prior offenses to get integrated back into society. And of course, voting is part of that, right? The idea that once you're out of prison, you want to figure out how to rejoin the society as a member of the workforce, as a person with access to an education, and as a citizen. There's a little bit of data. Be great if people could do this, crunch these numbers a little more, that suggests that people who are able to vote after incarceration are less likely to reoffend. Wow. And if you think about it, that actually does make a little sense.
Yeah.
Because the idea is that if you get out of prison and you feel like, I don't matter, society hates me, I'm never going to be part of this society, well, you might be more likely to reoffend then. But if you're someone who's like, my voice matters, I'm going to march right up to the polls and I'm going to participate in this election, you could see how that might have a psychological impact that make you less likely to do things that are antisocial. And for that same reason, I would want people to be able to vote in prison. Again, it's the idea of saying you're not some piece of junk that's locked away. You're still an American who still has the right to participate in our political process. I think that might be part of the healing. That might be part of the reintegration of people. So
that's so good. Like just sitting here listening to you talk, think about a world in which right now all the stuff that we're talking about, the election, which dominates so much of what's going on. Imagine every time you hear that being reminded of something you did 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Every time you do that and feeling, our system will work so far as people feel invested in it. And if people feel alienated from what is probably the single most significant public marker, at least, of one's citizenship, which is voting and political debate, think about how this just kind of blew my mind, kind of getting into the mindset how can I feel like invested in this community if I have no say so in this community?
Yeah. And you know what I do when I talk to people, as I do periodically, who are disfranchised because of a prior criminal conviction, folks that I've tried to register that can't, or people that I've been interacting with in other contexts, I always say, I'm really sorry you can't vote, and I don't think that's right, but let's think about ways you can continue to be part of the political process.
Right.
If you can't vote on election day, call your aunts and uncles. Make sure they vote. Call your cousin. Can you go register your family members? Can you go drive to the polls? There's actually an article in the paper the other day about people in Alabama that can't vote due to prior convictions. And this one guy, he's like, yeah, every election day, I volunteer in the election. I stand out on the street corner and I hold my sign and I canvass voters. And I'm like, just because you're not voting, try to find ways that you can be part of the political process, because that's true for anyone who can't vote. Whether you can't vote because you're not an American citizen, whether you can't vote because you have a prior conviction, maybe you're underage, right? I was canvassing voters for a campaign about a couple years ago, and I knocked on the door, and there was this like 16-year-old kid, and he was like, "Yeah, I can't vote. I'm only 16." And I was like, "All right, here's what you're gonna do on election day: call your grandma, call your grandfather, call your aunts and uncles, call your cousins, call everybody you know, tell them to make sure you vote." And he's like, I'm on it. So, encourage people to find their political voice within the parameters we have available.
Pippa, leaving us with some sunshine at the end of this interview. And I just want to add up asking, what's your current project? Are you working on anything?
Oh, yeah, real quick. So my current project is about the right to testify in court. So in the 19th century, when you committed a crime, you lost the right to vote, as we have been discussing. But also in some states, you also lost the right to testify in court. The article that I've written so far starts off with a guy in Tennessee, actually, in 1941, who was injured on the job. He hurt his foot in working in a coal mine. And when he went to court for a workers' compensation claim, the fact that he had a prior misdemeanor larceny conviction meant that he couldn't testify in his own workers' comp case. And since he was the witness to his injury, there was no evidence of an injury, and the guy didn't get workers' comp. So these laws extend in Tennessee into the late 1950s. I can't remember the exact date. They extend in Georgia. In Georgia, you can't I'll just leave it there. But basically, this question is how criminal charges and prior convictions affect your ability to testify in court. Those go away in many states in the 19th century, but they persist into the 20th century in some states.
That's amazing.
The larger picture is this idea of and you actually said this earlier. You said voting is usually considered kind of the measure of your citizenship, how you perform your citizenship. And what I'm trying to ask is, in the 19th century, might the right to testify in court have been just as important? And in some cases, like my coal miner guy, even more immediate. Like, this guy didn't get workers' comp because of this. So that's my next question.
Pippa Holloway, welcome back to The Road to Now.
I'm glad to be here.
And I'm glad you are here, too. It's interesting. We actually live a mile from each other, but you, as a coveted speaker and scholar, are in Birmingham, Alabama this weekend. But I did not want to miss out on an opportunity to speak with you because of what recently happened in Florida with the change to felon disfranchisement laws. You are one of the experts on this field, and I was hoping maybe you could catch us up on what the law was, how it changed the status, and why you think it passed.
All right, great. Yeah. I'm glad to be with you today. I mean, this has been an exciting week for anyone interested in felon disfranchisement and really anyone interested in democracy in America. The fact that 1.5 million people had their rights restored through a constitutional amendment that was supported by 64% of the Florida population is really remarkable. I mean, when we write the histories of suffrage in America, 2018 will be in those updated histories.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So your question was why it passed?
Yes.
Well, first your question was what happened?
Right.
Maybe I should start with that. What happened in Florida was the voters of Florida had the opportunity to vote on an amendment to the Florida Constitution. And the amendment to the Constitution eliminated the state's strict prohibition on voting by ex-offenders or former felons. The Constitution as it was said that felons may not vote unless they went through a complicated restoration process. And the amendment says that that your voting rights shall be restored following completion of the terms of your sentence.
And there's still several states with laws that are complicated like this that prevent felons from voting. What do you think it was in Florida? How were people able to spread the message and make the voters of Florida realize the inhumane nature of taking away someone's rights for the rest of their life for an act that they, according to every other indication, had fulfilled their debt on?
It's a good question. Why Florida? Felon disfranchisement in Florida received a lot of publicity in 2000 in the Bush v. Gore election, and the presidential election was so close and hinged on 500 plus votes in Florida. So I think the state of Florida or the citizens of the state of Florida had a particularly high level of awareness about the impact of these laws. But I think they also understood and came to understand over the course of the petition drive and the ultimate campaign for the amendment that the impact of these go far beyond partisanship. And I think the second part of my answer to your question would be, why Florida? Because people in Florida led a wonderful campaign. They built a coalition that reached across the state, that reached across communities, and I think possibly most importantly, put ex-offenders at the center. This was a drive that was spearheaded by formerly incarcerated people, by people who told their own stories about why they wanted to vote. And they made a persuasive case to the people of Florida that they should have those. And if you look at the results, right, the ballot had to pass by more than 60%. Upwards of 64% of the population voted for this, or 64% of the electorate. And if you look at the Florida gubernatorial election or the Senate election, we know that Florida splits very close to 50-50. The Florida electorate today is very closely split between Republicans and Democrats. So what this means is that, you know, a significant number of Republicans also voted for this. And I think that's a really good thing and a really good sign that people in America will come together on important issues, central issues that do cross partisan lines. And so I applaud all of those in Florida that voted for this.
Yeah, it is amazing. I was reading up on it, and it says that some categories of felony are still excluded from automatic restoration. Could you talk about that and how that went down and how many people that will impact?
Yeah, and I'm really glad you asked that question, because it's important to note that most felons in Florida, ex-felons, got their voting rights restored with this amendment, but not all ex-felons. And honestly, this was a matter of some debate within the activist organizations and within communities in Florida and really across the country that work on these issues. I've participated in those debates. And some people say, you know, if we really want to, if we really believe that in forgiveness, if we believe in you've done your time, you've paid the price, you are now welcome back in society in all the ways that that represents. I mean, many people would argue and have argued that everyone should get the right to vote. In short, a lot of people have suggested, and I'm trying to say this succinctly, there's a very good argument to be made that there's not a good reason to differentiate between offenders. On the other hand, people also argue that if you want this thing to pass, you've got to exclude the kinds of crimes that people find to be the most heinous. And in the end, that's the side that won the debate. The amendment went forward with the exclusion of murderers and sex offenders. But I personally know some people that did not vote for this amendment because they were frustrated with the exclusion of certain offenders.
Right. That's a debate that remains to be seen. Perhaps it's one that could continue on. For anyone who wants to consider trying to push to change these laws in their state, what's your advice?
Look at what they did in Florida. Florida, I think, will go forth as a roadmap for people across the country. And I'm already talking to people that are saying, all right, what did we learn from Florida? And can we do that in my state or in any particular state? It's really a glimmer of hope that voters will care about these issues, that the majority, even a supermajority of the population, will support reenfranchisement of ex-offenders. I would encourage anyone interested in these issues, go read about how to amend your constitution in your state. This was a ballot initiative, but it was a constitutional amendment initiative. And I believe in most states where this is a constitutional feature, that would require a constitutional amendment. So go read about that, figure out how to do it. Talk to activists in Florida. My assumption is that the people involved in this campaign in Florida will be sharing their stories and utilizing the knowledge that we developed in this campaign in Florida to advise people in other states.
Excellent. Thank you, Pippa. And I would add, if you want to know why you should do this, I know we've already said this several times, but go read Pippa's book, Living in Infamy. I have actually been on social media recommending that book to people, not only to call to action, but if you really want to appreciate, even if you voted for it, if you really want to appreciate the damage that you have helped undo, go read this book and understand the root cause that led to so many of the felon disfranchisement laws in America that have really inhumane and very racist roots. And thank you, Pippa.
Thank you, Ben. Thanks for making reaching out to talk on this important moment in American history.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now is produced by Ben Sawyer and Bob Crawford. Today's episode is edited by Gary Fletcher. We want to thank our Patreon members for their continued support. A special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Peggy Donica, Jeff LeCain, and Fig White. To join our team of patrons and get extra content, you can go to patreon.com/theroadtonow, or just go to theroadtonow.com, our website, and click on the support tab at the top of our page. If you're unable to support us financially, that's okay. We've all been there before. You can still support us, though, by telling a friend about our podcast and by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. That only takes a few minutes, and it does a lot to help us spread the word. The Road to Now is produced by Bob Crawford and Ben Sawyer. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer. And today's music, like almost always, is by the talented and lovely Paul DeFiglia. For the Road to Now crew, I'm Ben Sawyer. Take care. Osiris.